Wednesday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Fun one today. Two fantastic basketball games that we have to talk about. The Porzingis-Towns battle in Knicks-Wolves was awesome. And then the battle between Russell Westbrook and John Wall and Scott Brooks' return to Oklahoma City. Both these games came down to the wire. We're going to go into them in great detail. But first, what we want to do, bring back a feature we tried, I think, last week for the first time. Four questions. Danny and I each come up with two questions for each other. We don't know what those questions are. We're just going to try and answer them off the top of our heads and give you some fun discussion. And then we will get into the games. Danny was going to talk a little bit about Detroit-Boston, too. He watched some of that one. And I would be neglectful to not mention today that we are sponsored by Movement Watches, MVMTWatches.com/capspace is the URL to get 15% off an awesome watch just in time for the holidays. And then June, the convection oven that's basically out of science fiction. You put something in there, it automatically recognizes it and cooks it for you. Really just a fantastic product there. JuneLife.com, promo code capspace to get $100 off this incredible futuristic product. Let's get going here. You want to give me one first?
Sure. We'll start, especially since we're not going to do the month awards one for a little bit. Who is your MVP right now?
Oh God, I guess I have to say off the top of my head, that's the point of this, right? It'll be interesting to see once I really look at it. I guess we'll do that next week probably.
Yeah.
But when I really spend some time on it, well, let's go through some of the candidates. Chris Paul, if the Clippers were still playing the way they had been, he would be in the discussion, but I think both he and the Clippers have fallen off, although a lot of that's been that bench unit regressing back, not necessarily his fault. Russell Westbrook, obviously averaging a triple-double right now, is pretty ridiculous. And when you also look at Oklahoma City's performance when he is actually on the floor, it's been pretty incredible, especially when you compare with the fact that they really don't have much. I mean, the unit that they closed the game with today was just, you know, basically a Sixers level of unit, other than Oladipo. So he's got to be in there. Harden as well, putting up some incredible stats. LeBron James, I think, is averaging like 9 rebounds and 9 assists. It hasn't been as efficient, but the Cavs obviously have been killing it. Steph probably not really in the conversation right now. KD probably is. He has a 30.9 PER. Anthony Davis, Pelicans haven't quite been playing well enough, and especially without Holiday, but his stats are ridiculous too. Oh man, I guess, and this was, I'll steal this from NBA Lockdown. They were talking about this the other day. I think it was Cassie Hubbard who said that at this point, it's kind of more the statistics than it is the wins. And so I guess I would probably go with Russ.
I would pick Westbrook personally, but I think if they were to award it today, I think they'd give it to Chris Paul. The Clippers have still been great overall. He's the leader. If you want to use RPM, he's doing great in PBR, but it's a close race. And that's part of the reason why this is fun. I was talking with somebody before the game on Monday about this, and it was like, oh, you know, well, there's not use in speculating where the race is going to go now, but it is an intellectually worthwhile conversation just because it illustrates kind of what you value in a team. Because I think Chris Paul has done a great job offensively and defensively in a way that Russ and Harden haven't.
Yeah, but and Kawhi Leonard deserves to be in this conversation too. I mean, there really are. I mean, you know, there's, oh, in the conversation. Okay, in the conversation. That usually means in the conversation and then immediately dismissed as not being the answer.
To me, in the conversation, how I define that term is that you can make a legitimate argument that they're deserving of it. Otherwise, they're not in the conversation.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, there are probably 7 players that you could say that about at this point. And amazingly, that the guy who had probably one of the top 5 best regular seasons ever last year, Steph, is not even in there. And he hasn't even played that poorly either, you know. So really pretty incredible. All right. This is related to Wolves and Knicks. Kristaps Porzingis will top out as the blank best player in the league. And Karl Towns will top out as the blank best player in the league.
Oof. My first thought with Towns was first. I think that he has that potential. And I'm going to say, I've bounced around with it a little. I thought about saying second. Porzingis, it's hard because I love his ceiling and I worry that the Knicks aren't going to maximize it, but that's not a fair hedge. I'll say fifth. That's high for him, but he's a spectacular talent and there are ways to use him well that I don't think are beyond most coaches.
I'm going to say Porzingis will probably be 10th, just because he's not quite able to create his own shot. I think, especially if you put really good defenders on him, maybe he'll get to that point. Maybe he'll be like Dirk. But even, I mean, if you think about it, right, Dirk maybe had that 1 year as the MVP. That was really a down year for the MVP during that period of time in the, you know, the mid-2000s to late-2000s. We didn't have players playing at nearly the level that we've had over these last few years, you know, before LeBron really came into his prime. So Dirk maybe won the MVP that year. He was probably had a top five player a couple other years, but really more probably in the 5 to 10 range. I don't think Kristaps is going to be as good as Dirk, at That's least fair. Offensively. He could be better defensively, which could put him more into that conversation. But I think, especially when you consider too, I would say his ceiling would probably be like 6 or 7. But if we're just predicting what it will be, and then of course there's the potential impact of injuries as well. You know, that's, I'm kind of thinking more 10, 12, something along those lines. And then for Towns, did you say first?
I said one.
Did you say, yeah. Okay. I don't want to go that high only because I think actually that bigs just aren't as valuable in today's game as great wing players and creators, because it's just a little bit too easy to take them out of creating. And now if Towns can really get to like defensive player of the year type of status, which he showed the potential for last year, some moments defensively tonight, but overall their defense has been really bad. He's got a long, long way to go there. I don't think we want to predict that type of stardom for him yet, but unless he gets to that level defensively, I don't think he can be the best player in the league, because it's just really hard to get there as a true big man. I mean, we haven't had a big man as the best player in the league probably since, you know, in the last 10 years. It's all been wings, and even there haven't really been bigs who in this new evolution of the game who even have been, you know, in the MVP conversation. You know, it's been Durant, it's been LeBron, it's been point guards, it's been James Harden, guys who can, it's very easy to get them the ball, and someone who inherently has to receive a pass to operate, it's much harder for them to have as much of an effect offensively. So I'd say probably in the 3 to 5 range is where I would view it most likely for him. He does have that potentially get to number one, but I think more likely than
I guess I was thinking about it more in terms of ceiling rather than most likely.
Yeah I tried to, because people love to talk about ceiling, and I think it's more instructive to just talk about where we think they'll
be. The universe of outcomes is the way that I like to think about that. And with, I wanted to bring up with Porzingis, like, I think that if he can be, let's say, the 20th best defensive center in the league or better than that, then he gets to that real level of value, because if he can reach that sort of a thing, I mean, obviously if he could be top 10, that would
be he's got to be a center to get into this level.
Absolutely.
And maybe again, I guess if he gets to like defensive player of the year type of level, I think his feet might be a little bit too slow for that. And his quick twitch kind of burst a little bit too slow for that. And his defensive rebounding, I don't think he's ever going to really be a guy that you look at as like, oh, this guy is strong. Whereas Towns, I mean, he's already at the point where he's just like shouldering guys out of the way. Kristaps doesn't do that nearly as often. So I think he has a less chance of getting to that level defensively than Towns, but I guess it is possible with, I mean, his incredible length, his ability to go vertical. If
and
he can
his
be
instincts
that level
are
defender.
Good too. Like I noticed that a little bit tonight. Like he oftentimes, maybe he doesn't get there immediately, but he can get to the right place. And that's, I think if the goal is top 20 defense, I think he can get there. It's not definite by any stretch of the imagination, but it's possible.
Yeah, I am not quite as impressed with his instincts, but I think his instincts when he's actually there to avoid fouling and really bother shots is good. But I think especially when you have him trying to guard guys on the perimeter too. I mean, that's the thing. Like if he's stuck playing power forward because he just could never hold up defensively at center. And then I think there's a legitimate argument. Like if he had to play center in this game, he would have had to guard Towns for part of the time. And he can't do that at this point. He can't guard a DeMarcus Cousins. The defensive rebounding has always been bad when he's been at center so far. He's very early on in his evolution, of course, but if he has to play power forward defensively, I don't think his shot blocking becomes less valuable, and now he's got to close out in the perimeter on guys, which I think he's always going to be a little bit too slow to do it incredibly well. All right, what's the next one here for you?
The Memphis Grizzlies are 11-8 after tonight's action. Where, and you don't have to give a specific number if you don't feel comfortable, where in relation to 500 will they be when Mike Conley plays his first minute on the floor, his next minute on the floor for the Grizzlies?
I think KP is the best one equipped to answer this, and his article said, you know, a couple games under 500 was what he was thinking it would be. If I had to pick a direction that's more likely to go, I think it'd be worse rather than better from there, especially because they could again suffer more injuries as they so often do with this injury prone roster and not the greatest health record as a team either. So I'm going to say maybe like 2-3 games under 500 would be my guess.
They played feisty for a little while in the Toronto game, but not, they didn't have have enough firepower to really stick in it. And that's the type of game I think that they'll do a lot. And they face this kind of unfortunate thing where they have a lot of solid enough opponents that effort will not be enough to take it. So yeah, I'm thinking probably around like 3 or 4 games under.
Yeah, I was watching that game out of the corner of my eye. I mean, they had lineups out there. Harrison, Troy Daniels, Troy Williams, the all Troy wing rotation, not looking too good. And then Jarrell Martin and Deontay Davis, they're playing that unit. And that's just, those guys have some talent, but they might surprise a little bit. But when you're running that type of unit out there for large portions of the game, you're not going to win that many games. Who will have the worst record in the league at the end of the year?
Brooklyn. I just don't think they have enough. And
Brooklyn.
And they have enough like reason to try to make a move on Lopez that, you know, I obviously they don't want to tank and they're not going to do it for that reason. But KP and I talked about when we did the Tears podcast about the idea of the ticking time bomb, which they have in his foot and the Suns have with Eric Bledsoe. And the Suns were the other team that I was seriously considering. But I think the Suns have more talent in that sense of like, you know, game to game, and they have some guys that can really get better. Whereas Brooklyn just has a lot of guys on their team that I'm not completely sure are NBA players. They'll get a lot better when Lin comes back, and that will help a lot. We still don't know exactly when that's going to be. At least I don't know. The other team that I would seriously consider would be Dallas, but Carlisle is such a good coach and they have a lot of good young like wings, and those are the type of guys that can carry you to a couple extra wins you shouldn't get.
The news that Joel Embiid's minutes limit is being increased to 28 is helpful. Nerlens Noel potentially returning, although how much he'll play in relation to Embiid and Okafor, I mean, you imagine Embiid's going to play as many minutes as possible. Ben Simmons's potential return. The Sixers are projected for 23 wins by 538. So are the Nets. The Nets with a slightly lower point differential. And that's actually pretty impressive if the worst team in the league is 23, 22 wins. Usually there's a team or two in the teens, like last year with the Lakers and Sixers. So yeah, I think, you know, the Nets, yeah, if they trade Lopez, it's going to be ugly. But I think if they get Lin back, they could be pretty competitive. They found something in Kilpatrick who can be reasonably effective in some games. I mean, I don't think that he is. And also, I think the way they bomb threes, they have like a little bit higher upside on a game-to-game basis, like a little more variability. The average is probably going to be crappy, but they have a higher chance of hitting a ton of threes in a game and pulling a few out. And when you're bad, that's actually, it's helpful to have like a little bit of upside where you can actually steal some games. I'm going to still go with the Sixers. And I guess, you know, the Suns are in that conversation too, still to me as well. They're projected,
I think it's
for
those four teams.
Wins.
I think I was trying to figure out if anybody other than the Nets, the Sixers, the Suns, and the Mavericks were really in the conversation, but the rest of the West teams are better. And then the East, it would probably be Orlando, but they're playing better now. We talked about them yesterday.
Well, you know, the Heat had this rousing win in Denver, a game that I'd hoped to watch some of, but then because Wolves, Knicks, and I almost said Bullets, Wizards, Thunder were concurrent, I had to just go back and watch Knicks, Wolves afterwards. But the Heat have been pretty good, but there's always the chance of a trade there. They've been so racked by injuries. There's just an organizational decision to tank potentially there. So I wouldn't say, I think they're pretty unlikely given what their fundamentals have been so far, but just the chance that they could kind of pack it in still makes me think that it's possible for them. All right, are we done with that?
We are.
We will get to the games momentarily, but first, a word about your holiday shopping. I've done some holiday shopping already via Movement Watches, mvmtwatches.com/capspace. Part of the reason that they are so much less expensive, I'm sure, is that they decided to forego buying vowels for their name. They make the perfect purchase for just about anyone in your life. My mom actually bought one of her own volition. She bought some for my cousins, her nieces as well. Got one for my girlfriend, which she loves. I have the gunmetal sandstone, which I have really been liking. I've gotten some compliments on when I wear it. These watches start at only $95, go up to about $135 for the one that I have, and you can get 15% off as well by going to that mvmtwatches.com/capspace. And I think, don't just take my recommendation for it. If you go to that URL, just check these out. They look awesome. These are $400 to $500 watches if you're buying them at a department store. They cut out the middleman. They have a much more efficient, streamlined approach, so they're able to give you that same level of quality for so much cheaper. They've sold over 500,000 of these in 160 countries, so even if you're an international listener, you could get them as well. It's just beautiful watches. If you peruse through, you're going to find one that you like, I am sure, and you'll be amazed at how cheap it is. So go to MVMTWatches.com/capspace. Join the movement. Let's get to the main event here. I had watched actually a fair amount of both the Knicks and the Wolves, so I decided that I wasn't going to watch this game tonight and try to expand our coverage. And then Towns started going off in the first quarter and Porzingis was killing it. And those two guys are buddies. They've kind of similar games, are the two best players out of that draft class. And I'm like, all right, we're going to have to do this one. This was awesome.
It was spectacular. I mean, it started out for me, the story of the first quarter was Karl-Anthony Towns just dominating whoever the Knicks put in front of him, but the Wolves not really putting out anything. And then the game went, it was a roller coaster. It had so many sections and movements to it. And the fourth quarter was a great representation of that, when the Knicks completely took control and then didn't score for the rest of the game until the last minute.
Yeah, we'll get to that fourth quarter in excruciating detail, as we so often do on the show. But I want to talk about that first quarter from Towns, when he was uniquely situated here because the Knicks had absolutely no one to guard him. Kyle O'Quinn has that strong body, athletic, but doesn't have the intelligence level. He immediately got into foul trouble, picked up two fouls. Then it was Willie Hernan Gomez. Towns was abusing him. The Wolves were running a nice little dead ball play where they just set a screen for Towns from the top going down to catch the ball with an ISO with a little bit of space. He was facing up, hitting jumpers, driving right past Hernan Gomez, getting his shoulder into him for a beautiful rolling hook shot across the lane that he's been making this year. He was getting onto the offensive glass, getting fouled. It was really just a spectacular performance. He was 8 out of 8 for the 22 points in that first quarter. He finished with, what was it, 47? 15 to 22 from the field?
And 17 of 20 from the line.
The shooting that he had was ridiculous. 8 out of 10 in the restricted area, a further 4 of 4 in the rest of the paint, 3 of 5 from mid-range. He did miss all three of his threes, including a very crucial one late when he was wide open that could have tied it before Zach LaVine eventually did. But yeah, it was a great performance for him. And he wasn't perfect defensively by any means, but he showed some life really blocking shots that we haven't seen. And it was clear that he took their loss to the Jazz on Monday very seriously. He had some comments in the media, and other podcasts have talked about how he's really kind of very polished and he doesn't say much. And he actually allowed this that personality come out a little bit again, and he responded in a big way, but sadly it still was not enough.
It wasn't. And a lot of times in this game, I was just kind of sitting there thinking that his teammates, they didn't let him down. I think a lot of it was also the scheme. And as somebody who kind of has watched the NBA the last couple of years, so a big takeaway that I had from Steve Kerr's tenure was the idea of being satisfied with a bad shot. And the Warriors, under Mark Jackson, had that as an issue. And Minnesota, particularly other than Towns, because there aren't that many bad shots for him anymore.
Wiggins.
Yeah. Is that they can do better than they're satisfied with right now. And the Knicks did the same thing. I mean, a lot of the shots in the fourth quarter in particular, but throughout the game, was just like, oh, a mid-range two. Well, that's fine. That's good enough. And if either of these teams wants to reach the rarefied air that they have certain high-level talent to get to, they have to change their approach offensively.
Yeah, I thought the Knicks actually did a little bit better than the Wolves did, but Towns did not get the ball quite as much as we would have liked down the stretch. Wiggins, he really has regressed back now. He's about league average in PER despite that amazing 47-point game. He was efficient, but he hasn't been getting to the line recently the way he had been before. Hasn't been getting to the basket. He continues to shoot a pretty ugly percentage around the rim, just 2 of 6 today. You remember he had that game where he was 2 for 14 earlier in the season against the Nets, another game they probably should have won that they lost. He was 3 out of 10 for mid-range, and really all of those were pretty contested off the dribble looks. I mean, he's not spotting up for mid-range, at least. Like, that's one good thing that's gone the way of the dodo with the regime change from Sam Mitchell to Tom Thibodeau. But just 10 mid-range jumpers off the dribble, you can't be efficient in the long term that way, and he's regressed. He shot very well again on threes. He was 3 of 4 on threes, but when those are spot ups or even shooting that off the dribble, it's an okay look for him because it counts as three, and usually teams are still kind of going under the screen letting him have that, and he doesn't have the quickest release. So I don't want to see that from him. And the other problem is that when you take that mid-ranger, you're not penetrating the defense to the point where you actually might make a pass and set something else up. You're giving up on the possession early, as you alluded to.
You're also not drawing fouls. They're all spillover benefits of activity you don't get in that circumstance. Wiggins has only attempted 5 free throws in the last 3 games. He had 0 against the Jazz, he had 1 tonight, and he had 4 against the Warriors. He had a lot more right before that, but his attempt rate is actually now right around where it was last year. And that's a concern.
Porzingis' game also was really fantastic in this one. He was 11 out of 20 from the field. Still doesn't get to the line that much, but that's not really what his game is right now. 29 points, he was plus 9. And really, especially in the first quarter and the first half, he was killing the Wolves. Their pick and roll defense, they had to basically just start switching everything because what they were doing was trying to ice everything on the side. And so as soon as he got into range where they would call out the ice coverage, which as you know means the big drops back into the paint and the guard prevents the guy from going middle, basically kind of funnels him into that big in the paint, all Porzingis has to do is wait for them to call that out, and then he just retreats back to the three-point line and he would be wide open for threes, and then you can't really close out him. I think he needs to take more threes. He's had a lot of plays where guys are closing out on him. He's 7'3", he could get the shot off, he has a high release and a quick release, and instead he wants to take a dribble, and he's not really fast enough with a few exceptions to blow by guys on those plays, get into the lane and make a play. So I would rather he just bomb that three, you know, if he's going to make it, maybe his percentage will go down a little bit from three, but just take that shot. That's a good shot. I wish he would, he could be such a great spot up threat. And he's even had some unbelievable plays like going to his right. Like he can take one dribble and pull up for his jumper, but he still is just too slow getting all the way to the rim. So I would love for him to jack it up, but he was fantastic in this one and had some, a couple big plays late too.
Yeah. Well, something I wanted to bring up with Porzingis also shooting more threes is the way that teams often freak out when he gets that situation is that they close really hard. And so that's why he's choosing to dribble. He could also get fouled shooting threes a lot more than he is right now. And that's something that could come from it. There are various guys around the league that have made a living doing that. Now I think about Lou Williams all the time of taking advantage. There are a couple different ways of taking advantage of a frantic closeout. And yeah, Porzingis
just don't advise anyone to do that. We like, seriously, like 70% of the fouls in the league
it's
right
so
now
bad.
Are like blatant call seeking. It's real. Like, could someone just like go to the rim and try to score? Like, I felt that Jabari interview that I did that we played on the 15 and 60 in the Bucks section. I was so agreeing with him. I'm like, man, like I would love it if people just try to play. And you know, like if you grow up playing on the playground on the East Coast, for example, or in Chicago, like if you call a foul, because he referenced that in the playground, Derrick Rose is the same way too. If you call a foul and you make the bucket, it doesn't count. The thinking is like that if a foul is that bad that it needs to be called, it wouldn't be possible for you to actually make the shot, you know? So you are incentivized to just go hard to the rim and not call it because you're trying to actually make the shot. And while pickup basketball is not a good analog to the NBA, I would just like it if like guys just were not rewarded for this crap anymore. But I'm not really sure exactly what the solution is, to be honest.
And your approach about call seeking behavior is more relevant also to the defensive end, where that is the whole kind of concept of a charge, is that you're trying to get the call instead of actually trying to play defense. It's the same concept, just in a different application due to the constraints.
So let's talk a little bit. You mentioned this game had a number of ebbs and flows. The Knicks had 99 points with 7:42 remaining in the game, ended up with 106, but they really just could not score down the end. And then the Wolves really started to come back after the Knicks. It had been close actually after three, and the Knicks surged out to a 17 point lead, 99-82, behind guys like Vujicic. Kuzminskas was awesome. He had four threes in this game. I don't think any of his makes touched anything other than just the bottom of the net. He was really hitting well. And then they lit up a Tyus Jones, Chris Dunn, Zach LaVine, Nemanja Bjelica, and Karl Towns unit. They did, at least the Wolves at least did go to Bjelica and Towns more together. But I think more of the problem there is that Bjelica himself is very streaky and isn't really that good, and also is not really ever being used with the ball in his hands and can't stop anybody. You know, those are not really, he's not being used correctly, if there is a correctly to use him in the NBA. So I like Towns getting a chance to work more as the center, but that unit obviously hemorrhaged some points.
The benefit of doing Bjelica Towns, eventually they need more talent to do this. I think it could be a fun second unit alternate, you know, like kind of what if you bring Towns back and he plays a little bit with those units, to use Bjelica as there, and then also that relies less on shot creation from the ones. They have enough guys there, but it might be a way to make that work. Let's say Chris Dunn ends up being a better defender than creator. That combination, just get two shooters that maybe try on defense, it's probably enough.
Yeah, we should have mentioned too that Joakim Noah was out in this game, and then Courtney Lee sprained his ankle in the first quarter.
He was playing well. He was playing well before that. I mean, he was contributing. He had it was hilarious. Two of the Knicks' first three shots were banks, and they both were just beautiful. They both went in, and this can be a nice way to take advantage of the defense, just because those shots are incredibly hard to block.
Yeah, Micah Adams from ESPN tweeted at me that Porzingis leads the league in banked jump shots, which I would believe. He's really developing a nice touch there from that left wing off the glass. The Wolves defense against that Knicks second unit was really bad. It was a Brandon Jennings and Marshall Plumlee, the third Plumlee brother, was exhumed for this one. He actually played, had some moments here just by playing really hard. He couldn't guard Towns, but he actually was doing a nice job of setting screens. And what he was doing was just sprinting out so hard that Jennings was able to get a nice downhill start. But still, you got to be able to guard a Jennings, Marshall Plumlee pick and roll 2-on-2. You know, switch it if you have to. And there are a lot of times when Jennings would get in the lane, Towns was the center, had him totally contained. And then Wiggins on one time, Jang another time, just helped off a guy's at the 3-point line and gave up wide open threes when it wasn't even a threatening situation. So the Wolves D was really bad. And then they were able to get going again as the Knicks kind of went into stall mode a little bit early. And Derrick Rose had a bunch of bad shots and turnovers, got benched.
The Knicks played this bizarre lineup after that kind of sequence where they were playing Jennings, Rose, Melo, Porzingis, and Plumlee. And I was just sitting there going, like, what is the thesis of this unit? Because defensively, you got a lot. You got two guys who can run pick and roll. That's nice. And Melo can have the ball in his hands, though he basically disappeared during that stretch. And there's not much defense going on. You can't really take the air out of the ball. And they did rush a lot of shots. I mean, when a team is up 17 points with, I think they're up 17 with about 8 or 9 minutes to go. If you take the air out of the ball and just play hard on defense, you can probably do it. And they absolutely did not.
So we can talk about the stretcher. The Knicks, as you noted, didn't make a field goal for over 7 minutes until Porzingis had a great play on a dunk. That was after the Wolves tied it at 102. Gorgui Dieng had a great offensive rebound. He had two of those in the fourth quarter. It didn't play that well aside from that, but passed it out to Levine, who was wide open, drained the three. And then the Knicks came down, ran some beautiful action. Justin Holiday, who was in the game, did a slick backdoor. Kyle O'Quinn dimed him up from the elbow. Holiday blew the layup, and Porzingis went pell-mell right over Jang's back. I didn't think it was a foul because he basically had his hands on the ball, even though it was one of those plays that he was aggressive. You got two hands on the ball. There was definitely some body contact. He knocked Jang down, but it was just great to see that level of aggressiveness from Porzingis on the offensive boards, harkening back to really the first month of last year when he had all those tip dunks. We haven't seen that as much from him. And he had a putback dunk to put them up. And then there was a play you wanted to talk about where Gorgui Dieng had an open mid-ranger on the baseline that missed that could have tied it.
Right. So the Knicks basket came with 36 seconds left. The Wolves are down two. They need to make a play. And they end up running a play. I think it was a Rubio Towns pick and roll. And Rubio he didn't really create much, but then the ball gets to Jang. I think it was about an 18 footer. And he just goes, good enough. Shoots that shot, misses that shot, but Towns gets fouled going for the rebound. And since the Wolves are in the bonus, they get two shots, and that's how they tied the game with about 24 seconds left and led to the final play.
I didn't mind that shot that much. Jang actually has been shooting wonderfully on long twos. When you're out of a timeout there, having someone who's just open, a decent shooter with a jump shot, I think you'll take that. And then Towns was able to get the rebound, and part of the reason he was able to get the rebound is because there was some penetration from Rubio and the defense was a little bit flung. So I didn't mind that look. Obviously, it didn't go down. Rubio also missed actually Levine open on that play on the backside for a three. But it was fine. I thought, and Towns, good to see. I just thought his effort in this game, maybe if not his execution at all times in the effort categories, was good. So he hits too many free throws, and then there's basically like a 1 second differential at that point. The Knicks call timeout. I like that timeout because you want to make sure you run something where you run the clock down completely. You don't want to get Warriors where you go too early and then give up a fast break going the other way. And the play was just, you know, it wasn't a ton of misdirection. They just stood in place for 15 seconds, and then Melo just set a little back screen for Porzingis. That was enough that Wiggins wasn't able to deny him the ball. He got it in a pretty good spot about 16 feet away, and the scouting report on Carmelo Anthony, I guarantee you it says Tom Thibodeau is very prepared, says make him put the ball on the floor. He wants to jab step, get your hands down, and then pull up for a jumper, and that's exactly what he did on Wiggins. Carmelo has not been effective finishing at the rim. He's really slow at this point. point in his career, he wants to shoot that jump shot, and you just got to get into his body and trust the help behind you, especially as time is running down, and even, you know, trust your own ability to get back and bother his shot if he's really going to go by you. You know that he doesn't want to do that. Wiggins fell for the jab step and gave up the game-winning jump shot.
As much as I dislike Hero Ball in a lot of its capacities, if you are to pick a circumstance to do it, Carmelo Anthony against a guy who is not the most disciplined defender in the world is about the best that you can hope for. And they got the matchup they wanted. I can't speak too ill of it. Not because the shot went in, but just because there was a reasonably good chance of it. And while Melo could have gone a beat later, and that would have reduced the chance of the Wolves getting a shot, which they never ended up doing, then that would have helped. But it was fine. I'm not gonna beat that down. If it's almost anybody else, I will. But with Melo, I give him deference.
Well, I think the thing too is he's not just dribbling around at the 3-point line and then he has to go. They got him the ball in his sweet spot, 18 feet from the basket with a live dribble. That's the key there, is that he doesn't have to dribble into something. It's not as obvious. He's got plenty of room to make a pass. He took the shot at the perfect time. I felt like about 4 seconds left gives you enough time for an offensive rebound, but not enough time to set up anything really that tasty for the Wolves. And then on the other end, Melo was able to deflect Levine's pass to Towns after the Knicks did a nice job of really not allowing anything to come open.
Oh, I wanted to say something about that. The Wolves had two timeouts left when they got the ball after Melo made the shot and gave the Knicks the lead. And they ended up using both timeouts before they ever tried to inbound the ball. And I personally really dislike that for the exact same reason that I prefer a team trying to inbound the ball before they call a timeout to advance it in a clear foul situation, just on the idea that you still have it in your back pocket, you can still use it. And by virtue of that, when they started
they use the timeouts? One was to advance the ball and then they had to take another timeout when they couldn't get it in?
I don't even think they really tried to get it in. I believe they just called two timeouts. Like, they called the timeout, they kind of lined up a little bit, kind of saw who the personnel was, and then called the 20. I don't even think they even really tried to inbound the ball. It's off the top of my head, but that's what I remember.
Okay. Yeah, maybe we can go look at that. While I recite through a few notes that I had, hilarity from Mike Breen. The first time Chris Dunn catches the ball, he says, "There's Dunn, who has really struggled with his shot. Right as Dunn took a 3-pointer and airballed it by about 5 feet." and Dunn really continues to struggle. I think he's shooting now 25% on the season. And in this game, he was 0 for 1. Just not even really looking to do anything with the ball in his hands. He had 3 turnovers. When he does, like, he had a jump stop in the lane where he just somehow lost the ball completely out of bounds along the sideline from the lane. He just lost control of it. He got picked up in the backcourt and ripped by Brandon Jennings, who was pressuring him up. He just does not look remotely comfortable out there, like, not an NBA player. And Tibbs keeps wanting to play him, at least in the first half. He kind of sees how it'll go, and he actually brought him back in. He was in, I don't know how much of it was entirely his fault, that one turnover was, as the Knicks broke out to that 17-point lead in the fourth. But he's just not an NBA player right now. I mean, you remember, everyone was like, this report said, oh, they want to see how he's doing after 20 games, and they're going to trade Rubio. Yeah, I don't think they're going to do that. unless they fall so far out of it this year that they're just are going to give up on the playoffs. But as long as they're trying to win, Chris Dunn is not the right answer. And then Tyus Jones played a little bit in the second half, didn't really get a chance to do much, but Tyus clearly, as we've said, a much better player than Chris Dunn right now. Troubling because he's still, I think, if not 1 year, I think he might be 2 years younger than Dunn at this point.
I cracked up because I think it was right around, I think he tried it once, but Jennings had tried to get Dunn in the backcourt once before it actually worked. And then he just kept on doing it over and over again. I think tried partially to ruin Dunn's psyche and partially because he knew it worked. And so he wanted to try it out. And I just kept on cracking up because it's just a total vet move. And Jennings, you know, he's gone from being the young guy doing that to being the vet doing the ripping.
The Tibbs meat grinder is now in full effect with these Wolves. Obviously, I understand it because these are games they really need to win if they're going to turn their season around. I mean, they're 5-12 at home against the Knicks. That's not a great team. Like, if you want to be even close to a playoff team in the West, you got to win these games. Towns, obviously, you know, when a guy's going to score 47 points, I understand playing him 40 minutes. But Levine, 42 minutes. He played 43, I think, against Utah. And I think he was right around that level against Golden Golden State too. Wiggins, 40 minutes. Jang was the low man on the totem pole in the starters, playing 33 minutes. Rubio, 38 minutes. And the most minutes off the bench was Bielitsa at 16 minutes. And the bench was awful. The bench was a combined 2 out of 11 in this game in, you know, all the minutes that he played five guys off the bench. So really, he's not getting much production from those guys. I understand why, if you're trying to win games, you're going to play these guys this many minutes, but there's really no other coach in the league at this point who would be playing guys this type of minutes, even when you account for the fact that they're pretty young.
And for those of you who missed this game, they play again on Friday in New York. The only two times they play this season are a home and home, which is super weird.
Couple other little notes. Kuzminskas, who I mentioned, he has really saved the Knicks in this time with Lance Thomas out, with Lee out in this game. He's given just, they desperately needed one more option on the wing. They needed somebody who would allow them to play KP at center even a little bit. And just his ability to shoot, I didn't know he was quite this level of shooter that he's looked like so far. Usually Euro guys have to make the adjustment. He has not had to make the adjustment at all. And I thought that he's mostly played in Europe and for the Lithuanian national team as a four. We've seen him just get completely steamrolled even at the international level in the post. And so the fact that he's been playing the three has been, and can shoot well enough and, you know, hasn't killed them defensively at the three. He's not good, but they've been able to hide him enough. That's just been a lifesaver for these Knicks. Even Sasha Vujicic was not terrible. He was on the floor when they went on that big run at the start of the fourth quarter as well.
The Knicks depth guys have had a couple of nice games. And I mean, in this game, Marshall Plumlee overall did a good job. And so you have these guys, I think you could say they were much maligned in the offseason. They kind of used some of these roster spots on fringy guys. I wouldn't say Kuzminskas fits this bill, but Marshall Plumlee definitely does. Vujicic definitely does. But they've had some nice games, and Hernan Gomez as well. So that's a good job by them to really make it work. And I didn't expect that they would have to get this deep, especially Lance Thomas still missing time. But eventually they'll sort all this out.
Yeah, and when you consider Noah being out, Hornacek, they defended pretty well in this game. Mm-hmm. Hornacek, I think, deserves some credit for turning around this Knicks defense, at least to the level that it can be turned around with this personnel, and just not panicking, getting this. Are they over 500 now? I think either, if they're not over 500, they're close. They're in playoff position right now, I think. So I think the bottom could drop out of these guys. They are very thin. If more injuries strike, if Lee, I don't know how much time he's going to miss. They really are dependent on him too. Melo doesn't look great to me right now. I mean, he can have some moments when he gets hot, but as we talked about, he's not getting in the foul line anymore. You know, it's hard for him to be efficient, especially against good defenders. So they're kind of, it's kind of Porzingis and maybe a little bit of Melo or Rose or whoever else they can get some production from, and then pray like heck the defense holds on. And they're kind of doing it with smoke and mirrors right now. I don't know how long that's going to continue, but it's been a nice run recently.
The Knicks are 9-9, and 538 has them at exactly a 50% chance of making the playoffs.
All right, we'll move on in a moment to the Scott Brooks Bowl, but first, this from June. I hope I'm not stereotyping here for our dear listeners, but given some of the demographics that I've seen from that survey, we're about 96% male listenership, which is actually, I think, better than a lot of these basketball podcasts in terms of like the female listenership. But nonetheless, I'm going to guess that a few of you guys can't really cook very well. No offense to those who can. And actually, June is very useful to those who can too. But if you can't cook at all, you don't know what you're doing in the kitchen, June is a perfect product for you. You can cook a steak, you can broil a chicken, all sorts of things that you want to make, even bake if you wanted to do that, by just running a program. You put it in there, it recognizes what it is automatically, or you can manually set it as well. The speed is much faster than a normal oven. The heating elements heat up within 3 seconds. They're at full power, so there's no long preheat. It's basically like a minute or so to get it ready to the temperature that you want, and then the program will run. Like for a chicken, for example, it'll bake it for a while and then recognize when the chicken is getting close to done and broil the skin, so you get that nice crispy skin. It's really just an incredible product right out of science fiction. There's an app that goes with it. You can get push notifications when your food is done. You can check on a camera manually to see how it's looking even while you're sitting there watching TV. And it's got this great hardware with the camera, but also it's the software that really makes it stand out. A lot of times if you're an early adopter, you're going to worry that this is just going to be the first version. There's going to be a better one that comes out. You want to wait. With June, you don't have to worry about that because the software is constantly updating, adding new recipes. All of the hardware is so good that the software can just manipulate it as the June community gets larger, as more recipes get added, as it grows to recognize even more foods than it already comes preset with. Go to junelife.com and check it out. There are a lot of videos on there, great press as well from outlets like TechCrunch reviewing it. It's just one of the coolest things that I've ever seen. And my buddy is an investor. He just had one sitting in his house. I asked him about it and he showed me how it worked. I'm like, oh, I got to get these guys as a sponsor. This is really cool. So go to junelife.com. And if you enter that familiar Capspace code, you can get $100 off. This is basically the only way, the only affiliate that they have right now to get that $100 discount is the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. So junelife.com, Capspace code gets you $100 off that June oven. Scott Brooks returned to Oklahoma City. This was another very entertaining game. The Thunder dominated most of the first half, getting out on the fast break in particular. And people have talked about, oh, Russell Westbrook, his triple doubles. He's just hunting rebounds. Like, these aren't real rebounds. They don't help the team. It's just stat stuffing. He's taking it away from the bigs. Not the case at all. It does really help when he gets a defensive rebound.
He is one of the best guys in the league at taking that defensive rebound and doing something. I will say that there are times that he is rebound hunting, and it can be hard to separate those two things at moments, because if you're leaving your assignment to do it,
yeah, but they want him to rebound hunt, because as soon as he gets it, it's an automatic fast break. I mean, I don't have the stats, but when he gets a defensive rebound, the Thunder by far the highest frequency in the league in transition, and that's pretty impressive when you consider, you know, their defense is pretty good. That helps, but it's not like they have a bunch of guys who can space out to the three-point line. It's Russ just getting it and taking it. Like, nobody else on this team is pushing the ball down court on a fast break. They don't have like great grab and go guys the way a team like the Warriors does, or the way a team like the Cavs do with LeBron. So yeah, when he gets a defensive rebound, you better be ready, because he's just going to run it down your throat every single time. And that really, transition was the big difference in this game, because the Thunder had 25 fast break points, and the Wizards, supposedly a team that's going to fast break as well with John Wall, the same type of player, only had 5.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. And when their half court offense can struggle as much as it has the propensity to do, you need to get the volume of buckets and sometimes drawing fouls to really sustain their offense to make it tenable.
Oklahoma City started off with a strategy that they had some success with in previous years against John Wall, by actually going into the post against him with Westbrook. Wall is actually a little taller than Westbrook and longer than Westbrook, but Westbrook had actually gotten him into foul trouble in the past. Wall did a great job on him, and Westbrook actually shot very poorly until the very end of the game. He ended up 12 out of 35, which was pretty remarkable, but did get to the foul line for 10 out of 10. He got his triple-double with 11 assists, 14 rebounds, 4 of them on the offensive glass as well,
including that crazy valuable free throw rebound late.
Yeah, there was that one. He had this great tip in that really kind of jump started their run to get back into it, and so Russ, I think at one point was like 1 out of 10 from the field, and then he came roaring back after that. The Wizards, this was really a contest between two of the candidates for worst bench in the league. The Thunder won that contest. I should say avoided losing that contest, more accurately, especially in the first half. Enes Kanter was destroying Jason Smith. Jason Smith, one of the most infuriating players. We did that bit on him among the worst rotation players in the league, how he has all these turnovers. They try to run stuff through him at the elbow, which he can't do. But the play that really encapsulated to me what's so frustrating about him: Wall had a great drive down the lane, and then he throws it to Jason Smith standing on the baseline. Any normal player who's like a good shooter, and Smith certainly shoots from 22 feet plenty when he's above the arc, just spaces out to the corner and shoots a three. Instead, Smith, not only is he not in the corner, he's on the baseline and he's behind the backboard. So he catches the ball. The guy's able to close out to him very easily because he's not all the way in the corner. And then he just has no shot, and he record scratches and then throws up a shot that didn't even hit the rim, and they got a shot clock violation. It's just, if he would just stand further out, a shot that he can really hit, maybe he could be a little bit of a threat. And then defensively, he was getting absolutely torched by Enes Kanter in the pick and roll, even with Westbrook out of the game. They put Gortat back in. He fared no better against Kanter. Kanter had an excellent game, going 6 out of 10 in only 15 minutes. But then the second half, especially the fourth quarter, was really interesting because both of these teams went really, really small, despite the fact that centers are some of their best players.
And a lot of the players that they put in instead were limited in ways that don't particularly help. I think about Jeremy Grant in this way. You know, Grant can block some shots, but he can't shoot. So it's not not like you're getting that floor spacing from all five spots. And they're also playing Robertson, who had some really nice moments in this game, but does not provide that benefit either. So I'm just sitting there going, what are you gaining from this?
Well, I think the Wizards, it was very clear.
Sure.
Because, and I think it was just the Thunder, you know, they know that Steven Adams is one of their best guys. I think the Thunder just felt like they had to match up, because when the Wizards went small against them, especially to close the first half, Oklahoma City had, I think, a 16-point lead at one point in the first half. And then Kelly Oubre had a nice run off the bench, and they brought him back in and played with he and Porter at forward. And that was very successful. Donovan decided he was going to counter that with Cantor and Adams, and that didn't really work. So Washington was able to get back into it. And then they also, when Oubre was in again, they were able to go up by 7 points midway through the fourth quarter. And Markieff Morris had two free throws that could have put him up 9 with about 4 minutes left and just about ended things. And he missed both of those free throws. And then Oklahoma City jump-started their comeback. Westbrook had this ridiculous offensive rebound where he got a couple of taps. And finally, like, he turned it into just an incredible show with his effort in the last 5 minutes of the game, much as he did in that game against the Lakers about a week and a half ago, where they were down 10 at the same amount of time. And he just decided he was going to shoot every time. And this time he did it with his effort. It was unbelievable.
One of the other things that Oklahoma City tried over this was Sabonis at center. And I think that could have worked eventually too. They struggled a little bit with it, but
yeah, he's too slow to really switch, and he's not enough of a rim protector defensively. Now, he was 5 out of 5. I thought he had an okay game at times, but I think he going with him at center didn't really work. And then they went with Grant and Robertson, as you said. I thought Robertson actually was great. He was 2 out of 3 on threes. He always seems to shoot way better at home, going back to last year's playoffs.
I like Robertson a lot. He needs to be in the right circumstance, and I'm not completely sure that's Oklahoma City considering their existing flaws, but I love him as a player, and his rebounding is underappreciated at this point.
Yeah, if they just played him at the four and they had the personnel on the wing to do that, I mean, he just has to play a three because they don't have any other guys who are any good at that position. But he really, I think, could be very effective switching, getting on the glass, making hard cuts like he did in the playoffs last year. He had this one block on John Wall. Wall tried to go out into him on transition, and Robertson just timed him up perfectly and sent it into the seats. It was a fantastic block. What Wall usually does to guys as well.
I was just thinking about how much fun a 3-man 2-4 combination Wes Matthews, Harrison Barnes, and Robertson would be.
Yeah, well, I don't know that they're necessarily going to have much in the way of cap space in Dallas, depending on what happens.
Or Dirk, trade assets.
Amazing. Yeah. But you know, maybe they could get a sign and trade if just the offer is that big. I doubt it, though. Sign-in trades are, I think, not as common as they used to be because teams aren't as capped out as much. What else did I want to say here? Yeah, so Oubre was fantastic. Anthony Morrow was plus 20, even though he was only 2 out of 9. And it just, I think they have to play him. Even though he wasn't hitting his shot, he just opens things up so much. Just to have one more shooter on the floor is just so meaningful for them. And yeah, I get it. He sucks on defense. It's really bad. He was awful defensively in this game, but he still managed to be plus 20 for a reason, right? I think the other thing that I thought was a problem down the end is that both of these teams were small, with Markieff Morris at center, with that Oubre and Porter up front for Washington, and then they went with that crazy lineup for OKC, and none of them were switching on pick and rolls. They were still getting carved up by pick and rolls. If you're going to go that small, you might as well just switch. And you know, if you're hope to get some help behind them, especially when it's in Washington's case, it was such a shooting challenge lineup, even if it was a small lineup for OKC.
Yeah, it was frustrating when I was flipping over, because that game was close. Was that close at the same time as the Knicks game, or was it? It was.
They were happening like right at the same time.
Yeah, because you'd see those moments, you'd just be sitting there going, I knew about, you know, I've been watching Oubre do well and all this kind of stuff, but you're basically seeing the pieces not completely fit together well. And, you know, that can be frustrating, but it led to a really fun game, probably better than I anticipated.
Down the end, it was very interesting. The last two possessions, Washington missed a tough Markieff Morris post up 3. I think it wasn't a good look, but I think that's fine when you're really trying to run the time down as much as possible, not turn it over, go back and play defense when you're up 3. 17 seconds left. They got the defensive rebound. I actually would not have taken the timeout. I would have waited to, I think you can get a three-pointer quickly when you need it much more easily off a defensive rebound, especially because just the guys don't have it in their head. Like, okay, I know time and score. I know we can't give up a three, but things ended up working out just through due to the individual brilliance of Westbrook. They actually set up a play for Steven Adams, who they put in the game specifically to set the screen to screen for Morrow. John Wall had switched onto him. They finally did start switching everything on that play to deny the three. Wall just locked up Morrow. It was a great play by him. And then that left Beal, though, on Westbrook. Westbrook went inside the arc, probably still wasn't low enough on the time meter to foul. And especially against this great offensive rebounding team, too. If you want to have 12 seconds left, if they miss one of those free throws, they can get the offensive rebound. And now all they need is a two. Westbrook, this was just an unbelievable shot. I mean, he basically got all the way to about 15 feet. Put his shoulder into Beal, did not commit the offensive foul, knocked him backwards, and then just retreated to the three-point line. Great footwork. The power that it takes to just back up like that three or four steps and shoot a three while you have a live dribble is incredible, and he just nailed it. He's been hitting. He hasn't been shooting great from three overall in the season, but he's been hitting some huge ones. And then the Wizards decided to go with a pick and roll for Wall and Markieff Morris. Oklahoma City did not switch that. Wall did a great job crossing up Jeremy Grant, got in the lane, looked to be open, and instead decided he was going to try to pass it to Morris. And Westbrook did a great job of veering back, getting in front of Morris, who was not his man. He got screened off initially and intercepting it, so that led it to a deflection to Otto Porter. He had a good look at a fadeaway from the elbow, couldn't make it, and then Oklahoma City just completely blitzed them in the overtime.
Just because I think it'll amuse you, Russell Westbrook is actually shooting his career high percentage from three this year, 33.6.
I mean, when you consider the type, like, that's good enough to keep them honest, though, right? Like,
it is, and especially when you shoot them the way that he does.
Yeah, with that kind of volume, and especially because a lot of those are in the half court, and you know, the average points per possession in the half court is about 0.9. That's actually 33% from three. That's actually a good shot. And also when you consider that overall he's been efficient, and you consider that this team has nobody else on it, and their overall offense isn't that good. I mean, him shooting a three-pointer at 33%, and now granted, if he had missed two or three more of those, he'd be under 30%. That's the number of attempts we're talking about here. But if he can keep that up all year, that's actually a very good shot for him.
Yeah, it's not bad.
The play you talked about too, the offensive rebounding, that was really the key play, I think, of the whole game, where he just lined up. I mean, what point guard is going to line up on the offensive glass along the lane lines to try and get an offensive rebound? I think it was Jeremy Grant shooting the shot. He made the first one, and then he got a three-point play out of it by just going through two guys, one of whom was Markieff Morris.
The other was Otto Porter.
Yeah, like two guys who are 6'8 or over. Russ pushes both of them out of the way and just tips it in. Just an unbelievable play. I mean, pretty inexcusable effort, but like, that's just the type of athlete that he is. And against teams like this that are not that good, he can take over on his own. It's really remarkable.
And Victor Oladipo continued his ability to kind of hit up.
How did
shots.
We not mention his name yet?
Yeah, that's, Oladipo had a nice game, and he hit the dagger three, the three that really sealed this game.
Yeah, that put them up eight, I think, pretty early on in the overtime. And once you're down eight in overtime, you're probably done. Oladipo, 25 points, 10 of 16 from the field, 5 of 9 on threes. A couple of those were tough, but a lot of them were spot ups. And he has shot the spot up three well. They desperately need that. They'd like to see a little bit more playmaking from him still, but he at least had some moments on the second unit. Like, their second unit was not terrible today. Granted, they're playing Washington's second unit, but he was able to lead them well enough to where their second unit was pretty successful.
And I thought it was nice. You know, there was a nice moment before the game with Russ and Scotty Brooks, who was his coach for such a long time, that Russ also took the time to a tribute to his former teammate by shooting Kevin Durant's number in attempts and scoring that in points.
All right, we done here?
Well, also, I want to talk a little bit about Detroit, Boston. It was a fun game. And the story, the big overarching story of this game, beyond just Detroit early on completely beasting Boston on the defense, on the offensive glass, because Boston sucks on the defensive glass, was when Detroit can hit their shots, when they can hit the shots that are created by their offense, and they're getting fewer of them with Ish instead of Reggie Jackson, they're going to win a lot of games because they try hard on defense. They get enough on their offense that way. Tobias Tobias Harris had another nice game. He was 9 of 20, but 3 of 6 from 3. And then in this game, KCP, I didn't think he was as good top to bottom. He had some really nice moments. But Marcus Morris was just a problem for the Celtics. And so the idea of the Pistons being a really good regular season team when they're all together has been really confirmed by these two games. And yeah, they had some structural advantages yesterday because the Hornets were playing their fourth game in 5 nights. They were playing on a back-to-back. Yeah, the Pistons also were playing without Reggie Jackson, and Andre Drummond got ejected in the second quarter of the game yesterday. So they're a very impressive team. Boston is still putting it all the way together. I'm not writing them off at this point, but I really like Detroit. I think they're on the right path. I think they're, as long as they can stay reasonably healthy, they're going to be a playoff team. And Boston, of course, will be too, but we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, 9 of 20 on threes for this Detroit team is outstanding. 8 offensive rebounds for Andre Drummond, which is pretty remarkable performance. And he had 20 points, even shot 4 out of 7 from the foul line, which qualifies as pretty good for him. And Ish Smith was 9 out of 12. Like, you're not going to get that type of scoring out of him every day.
Yeah, every Piston starter scored between 19 and 25 points. And the other huge number, crazy number from this game is that Boston attempted 42 threes.
It's really, these were massive wins for the Pistons. They were 8-10, and on the road at Charlotte, on the road at Boston, two teams that you look at as probably above them in the Eastern Conference pecking order, you're looking at 8-12, and they won both of these kind of comfortably. KCP has been a monster in these games. If he keeps shooting the ball like this from threes up to, I think, the high 30s now on three-pointers, again, he's shot only 100 of them, so if he missed 4 of them, he'd be back right where he was before, so let's not go crazy about it, but he is going to get pretty close to max money if he keeps playing like this, because he's a wonderful defensive player, as we've highlighted for now a couple years on the show. And then Marcus Morris was someone who is really praised by Brad Stevens as being someone who's difficult to match up against. He went 8 out of 13 from the field, and this is supposed to be a good defensive team with Boston.
Oh, that was awesome. You may have recognized the DirecTV There's No League Pass Game On Right Now music, because the kitten actually stepped on my remote and turned the TV on. That was pretty bad.
Actually, I didn't, because the DirecTV sound is different than the Comcast one. Comcast one is worse. That was way more pleasant.
Yeah, but at least that music comes through in standard definition for Comcast League Pass.
Son of a bitch. I'm so angry. Right now.
I think the point I was trying to make was Detroit has put up two great offensive performances against what are supposed to be two really good defenses in the East. And Charlotte was tired yesterday. Boston was not tired today. And they shot 55% and put up a buck 21. On Boston, this is supposed to be like a top 5 defense in the league. Pretty impressive stuff from Detroit. All right, now are we done?
Yeah, I'll just give a little promotion to the podcast I did with Kevin Pelton. I'm doing a thing now for Real Jam Radio. I'm going to try to do it at the beginning of every month, getting a new national writer to talk about the tiers in both the East and Western Conference. And so had a lot of discussions on various teams and how they fit into the overall kind of structure and how uncomfortable it is to do it this early, but we're going to do that every month for Real Jam Radio.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love all of KP's stuff. And don't forget about the Twitter NBA show. We are not going to have a show tomorrow, but it's going to be an awesome slate of games. Rockets, Warriors in the nightcap, Cavs, Clippers, the featured matchup. So follow me on Periscope at Nate Duncan NBA, or you can just go to periscope.tv/NateDuncanNBA to watch on your computer if you don't have that Periscope app. I'll also just be tweeting it out. We're going to do a live halftime show for both of those. Going to get some promotion from Twitter too, so hopefully we'll get a lot of listeners. We had great numbers the first time 2 weeks ago, and we thank all of you for supporting that endeavor, and hoping to give you guys a little alternative to some of those studio halftime shows. Even as you go and get a snack, maybe just put the Periscope on and bring your phone with you so you can listen to it. No Dunked On tomorrow, but you can certainly watch the post game show. Will be pretty much just our normal gamer type of stuff, so check that out. We'll be back on Sunday night with another 15 and 60 on the West. Talk to you all then.